It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back to our program here on December 7th. We'll be taking a look back at the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor here today with memories of a local man who performed heroically on that day 75 years ago today. We will tell the story of Francis Flaherty, Ensign Francis Flaherty, before the hour is through. Stay close to that. Lots more good stuff coming up here on Current State. In early 2015, as the scope of the Flint water crisis was coming to light, Governor Rick Snyder appointed a new commission to look into the state's aging public infrastructure. The health hazards posed by Flint's deteriorating lead service lines brought the importance of reinvestment into sharp focus. Now, less than a year after its first meeting, the 21st Century Infrastructure Commission has issued its recommendations to the governor. The report says Michigan should spend at least $4 billion each year for the next 20 years to patch up its aging infrastructure. Joining me in the studio to talk about these developments and the report and a roadmap for Michigan's future is Mike Nystrom. Mike was a member of the committee and is the executive vice president of MITA, the Michigan Infrastructure and Transportation Association. This is a welcome back. So welcome back, Mike.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
The report your group issued on Monday talks about repairing a lot of infrastructure. It divides them broadly into four categories: water, transportation, energy, and communications. Let's start with water. Part of this process was identifying existing assets. Talk to us about what you found when it comes to water infrastructure.
Yeah, water seems to be the issue that grabs folks' attention here in Michigan. Obviously, being the Great Lakes state, we've got a beautiful Pure Michigan campaign that's been going on for years. And we want to attract folks to Michigan based on our greatest natural resource. So water after the Flint water crisis was a big issue. We looked at it from the drinking water standpoint, from beaches. We had 25% of our beaches in 2015 that were closed at one point or another due to some form of contamination. Mm-hmm. That's not a real good way to be inviting folks into our state when we're shutting those beaches down. We also looked at flooding, the state of our sewer system, our stormwater, and our wastewater. Folks tend to get fired up only when something happens to them, like in Flint, or when their basement backs up. But if we are able to flush our toilet and the laundry, the washing machine water goes out of our house and nothing goes wrong, we figure the sewers are in good shape. The problem is, unlike roads and bridges, we don't see that infrastructure every day. It's out of sight, out of mind, and so folks don't pay as much attention to it until there's a problem.
The report calls for investment in quote, replacing aging water, sewer, and stormwater infrastructure, unquote. How much money, how big a price tag is there attached to that piece?
Well, that's about a quarter of it. We're talking about $1 billion a year is the gap. So, you know, that $4 billion number it's a big number. And the reason it's a big number is we've disinvested, we've underinvested for decades. In the 50s, 60s, 70s, Michigan was known for the quality of our infrastructure. We protected our lakes and streams. We put money into our roads. We were the first mile of concrete pavement, first interstate in the nation. But yet, once we did that investment, we moved on to other priorities. Right now, since 2010 till 2014, capital investment, state and local, we are at 6.4%. Mm-hmm. Our neighboring states are at 9.9, 9.8% for Illinois and Indiana, 10% for the national average. 6.4% here in Michigan, we're well below the national average. We need to invest more. So that $1 billion number on water, $4 billion on the overall need, it isn't something that's going to be one fell swoop at the state level. We're going to have to look to the feds. We're going to have to do something at the state level. But also all of the communities across the state have to look to do local investment as well. And there may be some public-private partnership included also.
Let's move on to transportation here. The report recommends very similarly, invest in roads and bridges to ensure they're in good or fair condition and designed so they protect public health and safety. Let me ask, is there a weakest link in transportation?
Well, you know, we've been talking about this now for going on 11 years now. The legislature did take a big step forward last year by passing a $1.2 billion funding increase. It's phased in until 2020, so we start this year. We'll start investing. You'll see more orange barrels. Those orange barrels do mean jobs, improved quality of life. It will help our economy. Certainly, our economy is affected by infrastructure, and that was what we looked at. We looked at, as a commission, we looked at this issue long term. It's not only start fixing the problems we have today immediately, but we looked into the future 30 to 50 years. So this is a long-term view on this infrastructure problem. And with the step that the legislature has taken, we will start to see improvements in our roads, but there's more that is needed long-term.
We're talking about strategies Michigan can take for investing in its public infrastructure. Mike Nystrom is the Executive Vice President of MITA, the Michigan Infrastructure and Transportation Association. He's also a member of the Governor's 21st Century Infrastructure Committee, which has just issued its report this week. Construct a new Sioux Lock was on the list. What's wrong with the Sioux Locks?
Well, it's making sure we maintain the Sioux Locks. A shutdown on the Sioux Locks could have a devastating effect on our nation's economy. So much flows through there. Folks aren't aware of that. So we just pointed it out that we need to continue to maintain that. If there are updates that are possible through the federal government, we would certainly encourage that through Congress. Just keeping an eye on that system is vitally important to Michigan's economy and the national economy.
On the energy piece, reduce the frequency and duration of electric outages to ensure that customers do not experience significant disruptions in their service. The energy legislation downtown is being discussed hot and heavy here right now, and part of that is how we overcome the retirement of 9 coal-fired power plants this year. Let me ask you first how you feel about the legislation at the Capitol. How does that dovetail with your report?
We're supportive of it. You know, there's a couple pieces of the report that recognize that there were some things going on already. So that is a private investment component in a large part. And so we're seeing that some of the components of our commission report are already being discussed by the legislature. This governor didn't put this commission together for the next governor or for 20 years from now only. I think that there's a plan that he's going to work with legislative leaders beginning in January, even in lame duck with issues like the energy plan, where we will see some of these recommendations implemented very quickly. There are tens and tens of recommendations throughout this report. It's 192 pages in total, I believe. And so there's a whole lot there. It's a big menu for this legislature now, the next legislature, and future legislators and elected officials at the local level, at the state level, and the federal level to implement many of these recommendations.
There was a comment about natural gas safety in the report. Accelerate plans to replace at-risk natural gas distribution pipes to guarantee Michigan's natural gas distribution system is safe and reliable. How are natural gas pipes at risk?
Well, you know, the age of our system, it's just like we deal with water and sewer. We are looking at systems across our state that are just old. I mean, it comes right down to it. They're just old. And so on the natural gas side, I'm sure those owners of those facilities are taking a look at those. No one wants to see a catastrophic event. With regard to our water and sewer lines, there's over 1,300 community water systems in our state. Some of those systems were literally built 90, 100 years ago. So what we're looking at here is an old system that needs to be updated. We need to find ways to invest in it. We need to analyze it. One of the big recommendations of the report is an asset management process. We do that on our roads, where we drive our roads, the experts drive our roads on an annual basis and check out the state of our system. We need to start doing that at the local level on our underground infrastructure as well.
Making Michigan a smarter state. This is the communications piece, the fourth of the four. Lead in the development, deployment, and adoption of new technologies and the creation of smart environments and communities. describe a smart environment. What would a smart environment feature?
Well, as commissioners, we went around the state. We did listening tours. We went up to Marquette. We were in Grand Rapids. We were up in Traverse City. We were in Flint. We were in Detroit. We didn't just hold our meetings here in Lansing. And so in those listening tours, we heard a variety of folks in the community. Traverse City, for example, they have a lot of great little businesses starting up there. Folks want to go up there into northern Michigan and do their thing, but they aren't able to sell their product to the world because of broadband challenges. The UP, we heard big broadband challenges, cell phone challenges up there. So those are the type of things that we're talking about.
Is adhering to an asset management plan solely the state's responsibility, or how do local governments come to play in this?
Yeah, what the goal there is not immediately, but long-term, as communities invest in their underground infrastructure, they'll look at their various pieces, understand the age of it, where it's at in terms of its life expectancy, and then they can plan better. They can look at that system and plan investments long term. That's the real idea behind an asset management process.
I know that to generate some public support and political will, MIDA is getting involved here with a new campaign. It's called Fix My State. MI is the my piece. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, what we learned, Mark, over time with the road funding piece was that it took a decade to get that from the beginning when we began talking about it in 2005 to final passage on the governor's desk in 2015. We had to educate the public. And so what we learned from that was an ongoing campaign talking about the needs and how our infrastructure benefits us. Just educating the public on what infrastructure means. It isn't just roads and bridges. It's our water lines. It's our sewers. And how does that impact us on a daily basis? Quality of life, public safety, public health, as we saw in Flint. Our economy. There are all sorts of components to our infrastructure and how it affects us on a daily basis. People don't think about that until there's a problem. What we want to do is we want folks to understand. We want them to engage, understand how each piece of our, how each facet of our infrastructure affects them, how it's put together, how it's funded. Then, and there's no action item in this Fix My State campaign right now. We just want people to be educated and knowledgeable. Infrastructure isn't sexy. It's not a passionate issue. It's not one of those things that people get fired up on until there's a problem. What we want to do is engage folks, engage the general public, have them understand the systems, and then when solutions are presented, whether at the federal level, the state level, or the local level, folks will tend to support those things if they better understand them in the first place.
You're painting a picture of years of disinvestment in infrastructure in Michigan. I'd like to do a little deconstruction work here with you. What forces were in play that led to that disinvestment? That's a whopping question, I realize, but I'm really curious what you make of that.
Right.
This is infrastructure is your thing. What happened?
Well, I think there's a couple things that are going on here in Michigan. First of all, we invested heavily for 50s, 60s, 70s, even early 80s. There was a lot of investment in our roads and our underground infrastructure. I think what happened was we got it put in place pretty good. Priorities shifted, you know, corrections, education, whatever the priority might be. But in the end, those priorities have shifted. And then we have some of the toughest term limits process for our legislature in the nation. And so that puts a challenge. When somebody's running for reelection, they have a short term in office, they want to do a few things, asking them to increase user fees is a challenge. However, that disinvestment is starting to cost us, and without investing, we're going to pay the price because that $4 billion number seems big. If we continue to push it off and do nothing, that number will be much larger the next time they do a report in 5 to 10 years.
Has the governor's office or has anyone in the legislature had time to digest the report to the point where you're getting particular feedback to it?
Well, the governor has read the entire report. He is very supportive of the recommendations. His team, the consultants that worked with us, did a wonderful job. And, Yeah, there was a Flint coalition, a Flint commission, legislators, both Senate and House, that came together. Many of those recommendations that we have in our report, I think, will be considered in the near-term future by the next legislature.
We've been talking about the new report from the 21st Century Infrastructure Committee out this week here in Michigan. It details a series of strategies the state can take to maintain and grow a variety of public assets, from stormwater systems to electric grids and roads and bridges. Mike Nystrom is a member of that committee. He is the executive vice president of MITA, the Michigan Infrastructure and Transportation Association. Mike, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Good luck. America marks a somber milestone today. Today's the anniversary of one of the most seminal events in modern history. 75 years ago, December 7th, 1941, there was a bold surprise attack by the Imperial Japanese Navy, which decimated the bulk of the U.S. Pacific Fleet stationed at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. The disaster sparked America's entry into World War II. As the attack unfolded and destruction raged, one Michigan sailor chose to forego his own safety so that his shipmates might have a chance at survival. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now with the remarkable story of Ensign Francis Flaherty. Kevin, what do we know about this man?
Mark, we know that he was 22 years old when he was killed at Pearl Harbor. Flaherty was in a gun turret aboard the battleship Oklahoma, which capsized during the attack. His actions earned him the Medal of Honor. And we can truly say he was a hometown hero because he grew up right here in mid-Michigan.
The American Legion Post 42 in Charlotte looks like thousands of others scattered throughout thousands of American towns. In this little place off M79, veterans come to eat, throw darts, and find a sympathetic ear. The post bears the name of two sons of Charlotte. Private Irwin Greenwalt was killed in the war to end all wars. 4 months after the armistice, the world believed such an awful fate would never happen again. And that's when Francis Charles Flaherty was born. For decades, Flaherty's name seemed all but forgotten in this little Michigan town. That is, until another Charlotte native stepped up.
Very few people knew anything about him. He really didn't receive the recognition that he deserved.
Don Calizzi is 78, too young to have known Francis Flaherty. But his parents likely knew him quite well. They were Italian immigrants who ran the local soda fountain, the social lifeline of so many small towns in the 20s and 30s.
I was born in Michigan, and I wish and wish again that I was back in the town where I was born.
Francis Flaherty was born in Charlotte, March 15, 1919. And though they never met, Flaherty and Don Calizzi shared a personal thread. Late in his life, Francis's high school pal Bill Cheney met Calizzi and told him about his best friend.
Bill had nothing but adoration for him. He said he was a fine young man, always helping others, very well liked, kind of a class leader, quite intelligent, obviously. I mean, he planned to study medicine in the future, so he had to have, you know, some smarts to do that. But he sounded like the kind of guy everybody wanted to be. He was really, really quite a person.
Francis was named for his father, a first-generation Irish-American who went by Frank. He worked for some years at the Belden Elevator Company in Charlotte. And then came the crash.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob.
When stocks plummeted in 29, the Flahertys weathered their share of the storm. When Frank fell ill, his wife Gertrude took over his management post at the company. In 1932, double tragedy fell upon the family. Frank died that July. The emotional strain was too much for Gertrude. While Francis lived with his grandmother at her home on Harris Street, Gertrude checked into a sanitarium in Ohio.
Say it isn't so. Say it isn't so. Everyone is saying you don't love me. Say it isn't so.
Gertrude Flaherty returned home weeks later. One day in October, she told her sister she was going to call on a friend, but the visit never happened. Gertrude made her way to a nearby park and submerged herself in the Battle Creek River. Young Francis had lost both his parents. He was 13 years old. Somehow, Francis carried on. He attended Charlotte High School. The original building still stands. Today, it's an apartment complex. Again, Don Calizzi.
He was a pretty bright student, pretty active. He was on the football team, probably not a star player. Was in the science club. He was on Cheyenne staff, which is our yearbook.
Just before he graduated in 1936, one of Francis' peers on the Cheyenne interviewed him for the yearbook. What started as a simple question ended with a prophetic reply. The young man whose mother had drowned could not foresee how ironic his answer would be.
They asked him what his plans were for the future. He said, "I hope to become a doctor and serve on a ship somewhere." And the interviewer said, "What if the ship might spring a leak?" He said, "I wouldn't care. I wouldn't own it."
Flaherty went on to the University of Michigan. He still dreamed of a career in medicine, and that might be what led him to pursue a stint in the Navy Reserve. With a war already raging in Europe, Flaherty became a commissioned naval officer in the summer of 1940. And on December 7, 1941, Ensign Flaherty was in his bunk aboard the Oklahoma, moored along Battleship Row at Pearl Harbor.
From the NBC newsroom in New York, President Roosevelt said in a statement today that the Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, from the air.
"We will interrupt all programs to give you latest news bulletins. Stay tuned to this station.
The governor has proclaimed a state of emergency."
The attack was swift. 13 minutes in, the Arizona was crippled by a massive explosion that sent her to the seabed. The Oklahoma and every other nearby ship was in chaos. The defining moment of Francis Charles Flaherty's life had come.
When the Japanese attacked, Oklahoma sustained 9 hits from torpedoes that were dropped from airplanes. As the ship was capsizing, an order was given to abandon ship. Flaherty ignored the order to abandon ship. Instead, he shined a flashlight on the corridor exit and pushed his crewmates toward the exit. One of the officers said the last time he saw Flaherty, he was knee-deep in water pushing his men toward the exit. What was important to him was to save the lives of his crewmates without really thinking about the danger caused to himself.
When it was over, 2,400 Americans were dead. The United States was catapulted into the Second World War. In 1943, the capsized Oklahoma was righted and searched. The remains of 35 men were later identified. Francis Flaherty was not among them. In the midst of the attack, someone noted Flaherty's heroism. He was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor, the first man from Michigan to be so decorated during World War II. In 1946, American Legion Post 42 added Flaherty's name to its title. But decades later, as he began piecing the story together for himself, Don Calizzi felt something was lacking. He envisioned a more permanent memorial.
So we printed up a simple brochure and started going around town trying to get money for the monument. And amazingly, we raised $20,000 in 6 weeks. So that tells you something about the patriotism that exists in this town. And the monument was dedicated, I think it was either 2000 or 2001. But it sits in front of the historical courthouse in downtown Charlotte. We dedicated it on Memorial Day of that year. It was quite a program. We had over 100 contributors. And I'll tell you, we didn't have to ask twice. Once we told them what we were doing, we're honoring our memory of a Charlotte hometown hero. People reached into their wallets and graciously gave us contributions. We had contributions from anywhere from $25 up to $5,000 from one contributor.
Flaherty shares the courthouse memorial with another Medal of Honor recipient. Sergeant Michael Hudson was a U.S. Marine who fought in the Battle of Mobile Bay in the Civil War. He died in 1891 and is buried in Charlotte's Maple Hill Cemetery, not far from the headstone marking what should be Francis Flaherty's place beside his parents. 75 years after his death, a search is underway to find Flaherty's remains. In 2015, the Pentagon ordered the known remains of the USS Oklahoma victims to be exhumed and studied for DNA analysis. And since then, 5 sailors from that ship have been identified, including Fireman First Class Jim Johnston, whose remains are being laid to rest today in his hometown of Wesson, Mississippi. D. King is a forensic genealogist under contract with the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency. She's trying to find positive matches between fallen Oklahoma sailors and their descendants. So far, no match has come up for Francis Flaherty, but King says there may still be some hope.
It's my understanding that they have identified 32 sailors thus far, have had burials for 31. But I understand that the lab that's now handling much of this in Nebraska has made huge strides in getting everything organized for future identifications. So I certainly hope that Flaherty is among those. I know that there were several of his shipmates that, in addition to family, I'm sure, that were eager for identification of Ensign Flaherty.
For King, the work is about more than tracking data and donors. And like Don Calizzi, she also once had a brush with someone whose life was touched by Ensign Flaherty.
I had the honor of speaking with his bunkmate at the USS Oklahoma reunion we went to, I believe back in 2010. Mr. Ed Beasy, who just recently died, told me that they were in their bunks when the first hit happened. Everything went dark. They went to the door. Flaherty went one direction. Mr. Beasy went the other. And Mr. Beasy never saw his roommate again. And for years that had haunted him that, you know, perhaps if they'd each gone the other direction, it would have turned out differently.
Don Calizzi hopes for the day when Francis Charles Flaherty may receive a proper and respectful burial in Charlotte. Until then, he's proud to continue telling the story of the man behind the flashlight who sacrificed himself for his shipmates.
You know, we're a little short on heroes today, and it's kind of nice to have one you can talk about who happens to be from your hometown. And that's very fulfilling.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up on Current State, after nearly 10 years with type 2 diabetes, one Michigan man turned his health around with a plant-based diet. Mark Ramirez, who once played football for the University of Michigan, now says he's healthier than ever. Hear his story and hear about his appearance in an upcoming documentary about diet. That's coming up later this hour on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Since the election, there's been a spike in inflammatory incidents around the country directed at marginalized minority groups. The Lansing area has not been immune. Last week, a hate letter was sent to Muslim organizations around the country, including the Islamic Center of East Lansing. It said things like, "Muslims are evil and Trump is going to deport you," among other things. The Islamic Center responded with a peaceful public reply to that letter. Representatives of the center say that the letter does not reflect the Lansing community, which it says has always been supportive and positive. Joining me in the studio for Neighbors in Action today to talk more about this, Dr. Abdelmajid Katranji, who works public relations for the Islamic Center. Welcome back, Dr. Katranji.
Hey, Mark. Thanks
good
for
to
having
see
me.
You.
Thank you.
Also,
good to see you as well.
And Community Services Coordinator Farah Khalil. Farah, welcome back.
Thank you.
Dr. Katranji, as we said, the Islamic Center's reply to this letter was very hospitable. It invited the writer of the letter to attend a class about Islam. And you've said that even though the original letter was malicious, you want to focus on the good. Where is the good in this?
Well, the good in this is that when you see a letter like this and how it brings your neighbors and your community together, a couple of weeks ago, there was actually the implication of some white supremacist organization that was going to come to the Islamic Center to protest during our Friday prayers. And as soon as our local church communities, other faith communities, Jewish communities Hindus and other groups heard about this. We came to a Friday prayer filled with neighbors gathered at our parking lot to make sure that we could pray safely. And the event turned from something that could potentially be quite distressing for people to one that really kind of enhanced the spirit of mid-Michigan and Lansing and East Lansing in particular, one that neighbors care for each other and won't tolerate this type of behavior from anybody. This is America, and we're all free to be here.
Farah, you can attest to the support of the local community as well. Describe that support from your perspective.
Well, when I drove into the mosque that day for the Friday prayer, one of my friends, Alice Townley, who's the head of the clergy association, called me, asking me what was happening at the mosque and if they needed more people to come and protect the mosque.
How many people showed up in support?
Oh, dozens.
Okay.
I mean,
it was dozens throughout the day. So they started around noon, and people were coming and going all the way up through 8 o'clock in the evening.
Yep.
Farah, there are opportunities available for the larger community for people to learn more about Islam, as was reflected, I think, in your letter. Tell us about those.
Well, our center has many opportunities for people to not only learn about Islam, but to come volunteer and participate. We do offer the Islam 101 class on a monthly basis. We also offer Arabic studies for anybody interested. Both are taught by our imam. We also have a program known as the Ansar of Lansing, which is to help welcome refugees. And in fact, this Sunday at 3 o'clock, we're having a training session for anyone interested in being a volunteer.
What kinds of activities can volunteers get involved in?
We're looking for individuals to help with transporting refugees to and from appointments. We're looking for individuals to help with financial support, help when the refugees, come to their 3-month limit for housing. After that, some families need additional support. So we're always looking for additional housing opportunities to place families in.
And even beyond that, mentorship is a huge thing. So for so many of the refugees that come to the United States, a lot of them are actually quite talented. Many of them are professionals. Refugees, you know, come because they've been forced in a situation to abandon and leave their homes, their wealth, their prosperity, and have the opportunity to come to the United States to seek out similar, if not better, opportunities. And mentorship, it goes a long way. A lot of times we have many bakers that come, for instance. And so organized efforts with potential restaurateurs could help create community kitchens for these refugees from all stripes, not just, from one part of the world, but literally, you know, from all across the globe, they come to Lansing. And so that's one opportunity. Microfinancing is another opportunity where people can look at some of the cultural manufacturing that people do. A lot of the classic form of threading, artistry, pottery, some of these are artisans that if they had the right kiln, the right opportunity and access to these materials can produce some beautiful artistic pieces. So there's, you know, it's not just about please donate. It's about if you have something to give, we have people who would love to be able to share it with you.
You've got refugees with immediate needs, though. Talk to us about what some of those immediate needs typically are.
Quite honestly, transportation is a huge need. When they first arrive, they don't have a means of getting around town. When you're dealing with a single mother of 4 children, it's difficult for, you know, when she doesn't speak English, it's difficult for her to take her kids to school, find a job, take them to their appointments, go to the grocery store, that kind of thing. So transportation is huge.
Tell us more about Ansar.
Yeah, Ansar of Lansing is based on a principle that's actually quite spiritual for the Muslim community. The Ansar concept is actually the one who hosts or helps empower a migrant or a refugee. It's based on the historical migration of Prophet Muhammad and his companions, men and women and families, that left Mecca from the oppression in Mecca and went to Medina for the opportunity to seek refuge. In those days, those areas were like city-states. And so the Medinians, when they were welcoming Muhammad and his companions, were referred to then as the Ansar, the one who empowers those who have been, who are migrants or refugees. So there's actually a deep spiritual connection to help any type of refugee. It doesn't have to be Muslim. It's anyone who seeks refuge needs an ansar, one who helps them, empowers them. And the American spirit, and I think the spirit of Mid-Michigan and our community spirit here, reflects the spirit that the ansar concept is based upon. And so, therefore, it's a tremendous opportunity from both a spiritual standpoint and a community service standpoint to stand hand-in-hand with the All Faith Alliance for Refugees, which is a coalition of multiple faiths, including the Lutheran Church, Jewish community, Catholic community, and several others, and the Muslim community as well, to collectively be ansar for the people who seek refuge at the in the United States.
We can also point out, I guess, that you offer a translator as well for your volunteers sometimes to navigate the communication involved.
Absolutely.
Here. Absolutely. Yeah. You've got a Friday afternoon support group as well. Can you tell us about that? What happens?
So our congregational prayers are every Friday afternoon. And after the Friday prayer at about 3 o'clock, from 3 to 4:30, we have what's called the Refugee Support Circle. And at this time, any individual, be it refugee, and even if a non-refugee were to come in and come to us with basically any type of difficulty that they're having, whether it be, I don't mean to say this, but a lot of time it can be financial, and it relates very much to housing, or and once again, transportation. Those are the two main things that people put requests in for. But basically, any type of need that they may have, what we do is we sit down with them, we evaluate their case, and then determine if it makes sense for us to help, and then how we can help.
And you also wanted us to mention that while these services are mainly for refugees, others in the Muslim community who need support are never turned away.
Yeah, we do our best to address the needs of the entire community.
You've been at this quite a while. Is there a family of refugees or people that you've helped that stands out in your memory?
There are several families. I think the one remarkable one is the family that I've had the pleasure to work with. It's a gentleman who used to own a restaurant. His wife used to help them. They were very successful. They have several children. And they came to the United States. And the first thing he says, look, I don't need any assistance. I just need help to get a job and just to tell me where the opportunities are. And so very quickly, obtained work, hardworking, always showed up to work early, paid his taxes. I know sometimes people worried about, refugees, they very often once they get jobs, they start paying taxes, they start becoming economic machines. And so now what's exciting is he's looking forward to opening a restaurant here in Mid-Michigan. So he's looking at community kitchen options, him and his wife. And at the same time, this very refugee now has become instrumental in helping other refugees. So it's just a remarkable story of someone who's really beginning to capture the American dream. And now, he's looking for the opportunity of moving to hopefully, at least to own his own home. And that's the type of story that's repeated across so many communities.
For our listeners who want to get involved in supporting the Islamic Center of East Lansing or who just want to learn more, once again, we'll mention the weekly Islam 101 class. Farah, the next training for Ansar of Lansing volunteers is actually this Sunday. Tell us about that.
So the Sunday training is an opportunity for volunteers or Ansar to come and learn more about the resettlement process, as well as develop some case management skills on how to handle families. Just to give you an example, right before I came here, I talked to a refugee, single mom, and she needed assistance with her rent. But once I continued talking to her, she apparently was recently attacked, actually, when she went to Myers. She didn't know how to handle that. In her case, she desperately needed help with transportation, and she was saying, I can't hold a job because I can't get to a job. So when you're dealing with these individual cases, sometimes you can get sucked in. So the point of the training for this Sunday at 3 p.m. is to teach people how to handle the complexities of these cases.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking with Farah Khalil, Community Services Coordinator for the Islamic Center of East Lansing. Also joining us, Dr. Abdelmajid Khatranji, Public Relations for the Islamic Center. Many thanks to both of you. Good luck in all your work.
Thanks for having
Thank
us, Mark.
Thank you.
Good to see you again, sir.
And Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Help us out. Email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, please, or tweet us at KAR Current State. Tell us a little bit about why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State on WKAR. As a young man in the late 1980s, our next guest was healthy enough to play football for the University of Michigan. At 305 pounds, Mark Ramirez was a big but relatively healthy guy. But decades later, after poor eating habits had taken hold, Ramirez faced years of serious health problems, primarily the result of type 2 diabetes. In 2011, he and his wife, Kim, made a big change. They adopted a plant-based diet. Today, Mark Ramirez says he's in the best shape of his life. His story is included in a new documentary film, Eating You Alive, which will be nationally distributed in January. The film also features Samuel L. Jackson, screenwriter and producer James Cameron, and Penn Jillette. To tell us more, we welcome Mark Ramirez to Current State. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mark. Appreciate the opportunity.
Your early years when you were growing up in Mexico, your family generally was in poor health. Why? What was going on?
Yeah, so I grew up in Edinburgh, Texas, which is right along the border of Mexico. We're literally 20 minutes from Mexico and about an hour from the Gulf of Mexico, Mark.
Texas. I beg your pardon. I thought it was Mexico. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Yeah, we were really close. I'm only 15, 20 minutes away.
Okay.
But anyhow, we grew up in Edinburgh, Texas, and ever since I was a little kid, I remember my mother taking pills. I mean, she was diabetic for 33 years before she passed. And as I look back at the foods we were eating, right, and God bless my mother, it's no reflection on her. It's just we didn't know back then. And, of course, we know a lot more today than we did back in the, you know, late 60s and 70s and 80s even, right? So the bottom line is when I reflect back to a lot of the foods we were eating back then and the way we grew up, you know, I'm part of a Mexican family. There were eight brothers and sisters, and we grew up eating a lot of the traditional Mexican dishes. Unfortunately, a lot of those dishes were covered and coated with a lot of Crisco oils and lard and fats. And so while we ate a lot of beans and rice and tortillas and, of course, a lot of animal products as well, everything that my mother was cooking in most cases was containing some form of Crisco or fat or lard. So, you know, years and years of eating that, it's no wonder that really my entire family ended up coming down. All of my brothers and sisters, there were eight of us, and everybody with the exception of one sister ended up has battled diabetes at one point or another.
As a young guy, you were still healthy enough that you were able to play Division I college football for no less than Bo Schembechler. When you were on the team at U of M, did you think that you had magically sidestepped the chronic illness that was in your family?
I really did. I thought that, you know, hey, so this is because I'm exercising and because I'm, you know, continuing to treat my body, to get some regular exercise, I was going to not have to deal and worry about these issues. Later on in life, of course, about 12 years out of college, I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes in 2002, and that was the same year that, unfortunately, my mother passed, and as well as my oldest brother. He had a 9-month bout with pancreatic cancer and also was diabetic for about a decade, but he died at the young age of 41. And 2 months prior to that, my mother, after as I mentioned a minute ago, 33 years of battling type 2 diabetes, ultimately, you know, she needed a kidney transplant. She was legally blind. We're talking years of dialysis and years of poor health, and ultimately needed a double bypass. So when she went in for that double bypass, unfortunately, she never recovered and passed at the young age of 61.
In 2011, 5 years ago, almost to the day, it was December 3rd, 2011, you decide to make some changes. Why?
So my health, as I reflect back on my entire family, all my brothers and sisters, my mother, and I look at all the chronic disease and devastation that had shattered my entire family, I mean, I mentioned my mother, you know, passed at the young age of 61. My oldest brother died at the young age of 41, pancreatic cancer and diabetes. My twin brother, I have a twin, so he's been battling now diabetes for 16 years. He had a heart attack not quite 2 years ago. High cholesterol, high blood pressure, so multiple medications. I have a little sister, Sandra. We're 40. I'm going to be 49 next month in January. She's 2 years younger than us, so she's 47. Sandra, she takes 2 insulin shots a day. She has high blood pressure, high cholesterol, just multiple medications and chronic disease. Let's look at my little brother, Martin. He will be 44 in January next month. He was diagnosed with diabetes at the young age of 13, 14 years old. So he's been battling it for over 30 years. In that 30 years, he's had his right leg amputated. He's had a pancreas and kidney transplant. He's legally blind. He does dialysis 3 times a week. He takes 24 medications every single day. And so as I'm looking at my entire list of siblings, my mother, chronic disease, chronic illness, and the devastation that has caused, I had tried in the decade of since being diagnosed with diabetes to different tactics. I tried counting carbs, counting calories, portion control, exercise more, eat less. I tried all these different tactics, and while some may make me lose a little weight or feel a little better, and it did, but I was still sick. I was still taking the medications. I still had high cholesterol. I still had diabetes. But in 2011, we came across this documentary by the name of Forks Over Knives. So we saw this documentary, and basically, in a nutshell, the documentary chronicles 2 doctors, one doctor who spent the majority of his career out of the Cleveland Clinic, and that's Caldwell Esselstyn, and the other doctor, Dr. T. Colin Campbell, who spent the majority of his career out of Cornell University. And these gentlemen are both in their mid-80s today, but what they reveal is how harmful animal products and animal foods and high fats can be to the human body. So we saw that documentary. We also read Dr. Neil Barnard's Program for Reversing Diabetes. So those two things, watching the movie, reading the book, on December 3rd, my wife and I just adopted a whole food, plant-based lifestyle. And it was all really, Mark, coming because I didn't want to have to sit here and maybe one day ask my children for a kidney. I didn't want to be dealing with amputations and blindness and all of the chronic issues that I've seen my entire family go through. I wanted to live a life where, you know, we work 30, 40, 50 years, and we retire, and we're supposed to enjoy our lives at the later part of our lives. And unfortunately, what you look and you see what's happening today, the CDC will tell you that 75% of Americans age 65 and older have and struggle with at least 2 or more chronic conditions. So as we get older, we get sicker, and really a lot of it can be prevented. I'm not going to say everything, but most of it can be prevented if we just throw in some healthy habits in the way of what we eat. Exercise a little bit.
We'll point out that you and your wife Kim's story is part of a new documentary, Eating You Alive, which gets into the science involved in a plant-based diet that is set for national release the first of the year. And the time that we have left, Mark Ramirez, tell us about the website that you have created here. It explains the advantages of a plant-based diet. It's called chickpeaandbean.com. What will people find there?
So it's chalked with a ton of free information and resources, Mark, to help people understand. We share a ton of information, and it's science-based, right? I'm not a doctor, I'm not a nutritionist, but over these 5 years on this journey, we have read so much, we've learned so much from the doctors who have been preaching this information. Dr. Barnard's been preaching this through PCRM, Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, since the mid-80s. This is not new information, but unfortunately, it's now just bubbling up to where people are really grasping hold and taking notice of it. But the bottom line is, Our website is chocked with a bunch of great resources and information to help people understand the advantages of a whole food plant-based lifestyle. A ton of great free resources. And my wife and I are also certified Food for Life instructors. We teach people how to do this out of our house, or we can do it also in a corporate setting as well.
Okay. All right. We've been talking with Mark Ramirez of Clinton Township, who vastly improved his health. He says he's healthier than ever after adopting a plant-based diet. He is also featured in a new documentary film, Eating You Alive. He and his wife, Kim, started a website all about plant-based diet called chickpeaandbean.com. Mark Ramirez, great to hear your story. Thanks for joining us.
Mark, thank you for the opportunity. Have a great day.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, grief can be difficult to handle on a regular calendar day, but how do you cope during the holidays when everything's supposed to be merry and bright? We'll ask a local counselor for help in dealing with the many aspects of grief during the holidays. Plus, the Lansing Symphony holiday concert sleigh rides into the Wharton Center this weekend. We'll speak with the singer taking center stage, plus the director getting the students of the MSU Youth Chorale ready for the LSO. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast anywhere, anytime, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. Hope to see you tomorrow on Current State on 90.5 WKAR.